frequently talking to people down in Florida on 10 meters, so the slow rotation, sometimes that happens on the polarity. Anyway, I just want to mention again for anyone interested, I have a series of links on a webpage. The webpage is, just open your browser and type roy.ac2gs.com, and it will have links to everything that I talk about tonight. And in addition, I posted a web link for an article that Paul is going to allude to later on the space report. If there's any questions, comments, suggestions, or opinions, feel free to email me at mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, that's mailbag@ac2gs.com. And if you want to go into the chat room, which I usually watch through the TechNet, you can reach that by typing in chat.ac2gs.com. Let me drop. Okay, NASA's $600 million Kepler Space Telescope, which has been more or less running on thruster fuel fumes nearly a decade, after its launch in 2009, woke up from a four-week hibernation phase last Thursday and is transmitting data back to Earth, space.com reported last Friday. If all goes well, it may even be capable of continuing its mission to detect more exoplanets in distant star systems. After waking up from its hibernation, Kepler began transmitting the data it gathered from its 1880-day survey of its K2 phase, an extension of its original mission launched after the craft suffered a mechanical malfunction in its steering system in 2013. Kepler's signals are received by NASA's Deep Space Network, an array of receiver dishes around the globe. If there's enough remaining fuel, NASA staff may try to use Kepler for a 19th observation mission. Let me drop.
Roy, let me say a couple words.
Yeah, sure.
I'm not sure if you have a different amount of power capability on a different transmitter or the same transmitter or a different antenna capability. Tonight, your signal is 80% audio, 20% noise. Very clean, good sounding signal, but there's a continuous hiss at 20% of the amplitude of the noise tonight with your current method of transmission. You can obviously proceed as is, it's good enough, but if there's a way of making any change, some people would consider it a little bit more pleasant not to hear the noise. Over to you, Roy, K2LAW in the TechNet.
I'm twiddling things around. Is this any better?
No change. Absolutely the same. If you had an aimable antenna and you want to tell me every 5 degrees what azimuth is, I can tell you when it's the strongest. Or if you've got to have multiple antennas to try, right now, whatever you changed sounds identical. Still 20% noise. Maybe it's 15% noise, but you know what I mean.
Yeah, I don't know. I have it as much as the output. I mean, I could put my overthrusters on. The only trouble is it's probably going to ruin my own recording that I'm doing. And mic number one seems to have problems of his own getting this transmission tonight. So I don't want to screw up my only means of having a copy of this for the archive.
In that case, proceed as is. It's more than good enough. Go ahead, Roy. By the way, Roy.
Let's see. Fuel supplies were originally only expected to last for 10 such sessions during the K2 phase, but Kepler has just been going on. The hibernation phase was intended to further stretch out Kepler's tiny amount of fuel and ensure it was oriented during its assigned space network construct. During its original phase, Kepler scanned 106,000 stars, eventually discovering 2,242 candidate exoplanets and 1,327 confirmed exoplanets. The extended K2 phase of the mission, which uses a workaround involving the pressure of the sun's rays to help stabilize Kepler following the steering system malfunction, isn't perfect, but it still identifies a further 479 candidate exoplanets and confirmed 323 other planets. Kepler identifies exoplanets by what is called the transit method, which basically means that stars observable incandescence as
Roy, that time you faded out entirely, and right now most of that transmission was 85%.
Repeater, timeout.
Most of that transmission, Roy, was 85% noise, 15%. So whatever your original method of transmission was, please go back to that because it didn't fade out. And maybe maybe one of the receiver inputs is not operating tonight. If Eric is listening, maybe he'll be able to make a change. But go back to your first system because on that last transmission you faded out entirely, Roy. AC2GS, K2LAW on the TechNet.
You're getting D-sets. WV2H, WWTIC, you're getting some D-sets on the input.
AC2GS, K2LAW, are you there, Roy? We've heard nothing for the last 40 seconds.
See, you're getting some D-sets.
No copy, Roy. We can hear a little bit of carrier popping in periodically, but essentially no audio. Eric, KE2EJ, are you available? K2RIW?
HWW.
Yeah, we heard you saying that there's descents on the input. I wonder if Eric has turned off one of the receiver paths that favors Roy. That's a guess as to what might be aggravating the condition. Over to you, Howie.
I just programmed the remote base and went on the input, and I can hear him okay. All right, let me drop my transmitter and get back to listening to this. K2RIW, WDJWW. Sorry to bust in, but I just want to let you know it's not his equipment.
I know it's not his equipment. I know it's the receiver's site tonight is less sensitive for some reason. Maybe Eric can make a change to that. K2EJ, if you're available. K2RIW.
What a good idea, Dick. But he made a great comment about using diversity reception on 10 meters. I've been playing around with that with the repeater stuff, trying to listen to two signals on different antennas. And that's very interesting. Good night, Dick.
Yeah, with the stereo headphones, you can hear the signal drift back and forth inside of your head. That's a very interesting characteristic sometimes, particularly on sideband. Okay, let's hope that the system's going to improve because the last couple of transmissions, Roy, were almost uncopyable. AC2GS for another try, K2RIW. Roy, you were only there 5% of the time. So it could be a propagation change, or it could be a descent going on at the repeater site. And it probably is going to change over the next half hour or hour. So for the time being, because you are right now essentially uncopyable, let's switch over to the SpaceNet for now, and then we'll reschedule you after the SpaceNet. Is that okay, Roy? AC2GS, K2RIW. Can anybody hear Roy to see if he got that message? K2RIW. I'm going to assume he got that message. So, Paul, let's hope that your signal is coming in good tonight, and you might have to use the alternate technique. WS2N with the space report. We're going to switch things around and then come back to the science talk. WS2N, K2RIW. And boy, that polar satellite that's going toward the sun, which I think is going to be the fastest thing mankind has ever issued, that's going to give us some very interesting data, isn't it, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
certainly is, and this is WS2N, and let's do a radio check, see if I should go to a different system. How's the copy deck?
Essentially dead full quieting. You sound beautiful. Please proceed.
Okay, yeah. Maybe one of the inputs is dialed up for Roy. Maybe he'll get that straightened out with Eric. Hopefully he comes back. I know he has that capability. Yeah, the Parker, that's the name of it. It's named after Eugene Parker. The Parker solar probe was launched successfully, actually, this morning at 3:31 this morning from Cape Canaveral. I've been talking about this for many weeks now. It launched on a Delta IV Heavy rocket. The Delta IV Heavy rocket is NASA's biggest rocket. You know, since then, SpaceX has built one a lot more powerful. But all these years, if NASA wanted to launch something heavy, they would use the Delta IV Heavy. Or if they wanted to launch something very small and go very fast, they would use that rocket. And that's what they used. It's three massive boosters, Delta IV rocket. You take three of them and put them together, and that's what you get. And each rocket, they use liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. They're called the RS-68A rockets. Essentially, they're the same rocket, design that the space shuttle used. Space shuttle had the RS-25A, and this is very similar to it. It just does not have the reusability capability that the space shuttle had. Those engines would come back, and they would reuse them over and over again. The RS-68A on the Delta IV, they're expendable. They wind up in the ocean. So there's essentially three of these things because there's three boosters strapped together at launch, and each one delivers over 700,000 pounds of thrust. So it's, you know, like 20 over 2 million pounds of thrust. So SpaceX has their heavy version, which is probably twice the thrust, but still it's not bad for NASA all these years using that particular rocket. The rocket, you know, that video can be seen. I put it on, Roy put it on his website for me, roy.ac2gs.com. If you go there, in fact, he has right at the top of the group. You click on that, and it brings you, it's a URL that brings you to all you ever really wanted to know about this Parker solar probe that's going to the sun. And as you scroll down page after page at the very bottom, they do have a video, and you can click on that. And this website is spaceinsider.com. That's what it is. So they do very good coverage, and you can look at this video. If you've ever seen a Delta IV heavy launch, it's pretty dramatic. You know, it's a nighttime launch, and everything lights up. They have sparklers that go off right before launch. Any gaseous hydrogen in the area ignites. It looks like the whole side of the rocket is going up in flames. Then the three engines ignite, and then this thing takes off. And nighttime flight, you can actually watch the boosters going into orbit and actually separating from the main core. The two strap-on boosters on the port and starboard side, they separate, they wind up in the ocean, and the core continues on. Eventually, that drops off, and then they go to animation to show you what that looks like. And then after that, they have a, what they call it, a 48 solid booster that takes it further and faster. And as this spacecraft is only like 1,500 pounds, it's not heavy. But they need to accelerate this at a tremendous speed. The idea is to get this thing to the sun. And even so, it's a very light rocket, to try to slow it down so that the sun picks up the gravity so it gets near the sun. The goal is to get to within 3.7 million miles of the sun. So less than 4 million miles within the corona of that sun. That's the ultimate goal, to get to that distance. But to do that, they have to bleed off tremendous amount of speed. As the Earth is going around the sun, we're traveling at 67,000 miles per hour. So that happens hour after hour, year after year. To fall into the sun and get the gravity to pull in, you have to bleed off, well, not 67,000, but around 53,000 miles. You still need about 14,000 left over, because if you don't have that, you're going to actually get pulled right into the sun. So you do have to have some sideward motion around the sun. But still, you have to get rid of 53,000 miles per hour. To do that, to give you an idea, when we go into orbit, we go at 17,500 miles per hour, not 53,000. To break free of the Earth orbit, you need to go around 25,000 miles per hour. And to go off to Mars, you need to get around 32,000 or so miles per hour away from Earth, such as all our Mars launches, or the New Horizon that went off to Pluto. You know, they eventually got up to 38,000 miles per hour, but still, it's still not the 53,000 that you need. So the Delta IV will give you quite a bit of it would slow down that forward motion quite a bit, but you're still going to have a lot left over. You know, maybe you need another 15,000 miles to slow down. To get that, they're going to pass Venus year after year and get caught up in the gravity well of Venus. And that's going to happen seven different times. So seven different orbits around the sun. Every time it gets past Venus, it goes on the proper side of Venus, and it will actually slow the spacecraft down, around 2,000 miles each pass, and that will eventually get it down to its proper forward speed of 14,000 miles an hour, instead of the original 67,000 miles that we're doing out here in Earth orbit. Now, with that, the gravitation pull of the sun, every time it gets near the sun, it's going to be going faster and faster. Eventually, we'll be going some 430,000 miles an hour. I mean, that's like going from New York to Washington, D.C., I think, in 1 second. So that's the goal. And then first science missions, we don't have to wait 7 years. Even so, it will not get to its ideal point of 3.7 or 8 million miles from the sun in the first year. It'll still get pretty close. So we only have to wait this October, to get the first science results as it gets close, past Venus, start getting closer and closer to the sun. And then every year after that, it will be, getting to its ultimate goal. And that's the story on the Parker Solar Probe, named after his fellow Eugene Parker. Eugene Parker, he was an astrophysicist type guy when he was younger, in the 1950s. He's the one that predicted that there's solar wind out there, and the comet, the reason the comet's tail is going off in one direction. Meanwhile, the comet is moving in another direction. It has nothing to do with the forward speed of the comet, but it has to do with solar wind leaving the sun. And he's the one that they decided to name the spacecraft after. NASA always, in the past, has named all these different spacecraft, usually after somebody that, some scientist that has died, that has passed on. This guy's still alive. He's like 91 years old. He was at the launch. In fact, if you go to that website, roy.ac2gs.com, and click on that one link to the Parker Solar Probe, as you scroll down the page, you could actually see a picture of this guy. He's looking up, watching this thing take off. So it's a night flight, and it was 3:30 in the morning. It was supposed to go off the night before, but the Delta IV had some technical issues, and they waited a day. And now, why is it a night flight? Reason for that, it was, a couple hours later, it would be morning, and it, by that time, a couple hours, within an hour or two, the solar probe will be heading into daylight, which is where it wants to go, directly to the sun. So that's it on the solar probe. I'm very happy to see the thing get off the ground. You never know what these kind of launches. Launched a very successful rocket that's been used over, I think about 10 different times. The Delta IV has gone a lot more times, maybe 50, 60 times. But the Delta IV Heavy, I think it's around 10 times. One of the last famous launches by the Delta IV was the Orion spacecraft that will eventually be taking people into space. They launched that in 2012, in December, just to test an unmanned version of the Orion spacecraft, and they wanted to test the heat shield and all, and since the spacecraft was so heavy, they decided to put it on the Delta IV. So that was a flight where they went 3,000 miles out to Earth, off of Earth, and they turned around and came back and fired the engine to make themselves even go faster to duplicate what the heat shield would normally feel like coming back from the moon or Mars.
I'd like to add a couple of words on velocity when you get a chance, Paul.
Okay, I was just about to unkey for questions before I go on with any other topics, so sure, back to you, Dick. K2RIWWS20.
There are two missions that NASA has sent that go out of the solar system, the Pioneers and the Voyager. In either case, if they had to have enough rocket power to get to where they are right now, the blast-off rocket would have to be many times larger. What they used in the case of Voyager, for instance, was to use a flyby of Jupiter, I think Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, in other words, by doing a gravity assist, by going on the outer edge of the, by steering the spacecraft near the planet, and the planet has quite a bit of forward velocity because of its orbit around the sun. You pick up a change in your direction when you do a flyby because of the gravity that you sense as you go near the planet, but you pick up a fraction of its velocity. And so Voyager, I think, went by, I'm not sure whether or not it went by Mars, but I know it went by Jupiter and Saturn and maybe Uranus. And so each one of those flybys gave it a gravity assist if you flew on the right-hand side of the planet. If you had decided to fly on the left-hand side of the planet, fly in front of it instead of behind it, so to speak, you would then would be slowing yourself down, and you could even reverse your direction. You choose the right path in front of the planet, and instead of going around the sun in the normal counterclockwise manner, you could actually make your path a little bit more clockwise, if you know what I mean. So depending on which direction you fly by another planet, you can make a gravity assist or a gravity detriment. Let me drop. That's fact number one. Fact number two, when you fly a spacecraft away from the Earth, when you're at a greater distance than, let's say, the moon, you think you're in free space. Not at all. You're now flying either toward or away from the gravity well of the sun. You are now a solar object. When you get more than a lunar distance away from us, per se. Obviously, the amount of gravity you sense from the Earth never goes to zero, but it gets to such a small number when you're more than a lunar distance that the Sun dominates. So when you're flying toward Pluto, so to speak, you're flying up and away from the Sun, and the Sun ordinarily would continuously be slowing you down if you weren't using these gravity assists. Now when you take the Parker spacecraft and you fly it toward the Sun, you're now doing the opposite. You're going down the well instead of up out of the well, so to speak. So the Sun is going to speed you up like crazy. And so now you have to fly by Venus and maybe Mercury, but Venus for sure, and flying on the right side of Venus. Each time you pass in front of Venus, Venus will give you a slowdown. You're not using Venus for a gravity assist. You're using it for a gravity detriment. So I think what's happening on this first pass is they're going to do a whip around the Sun, come back to Venus to slow down, and do that process a number of times. So the maximum velocity that Parker is going to get, is it the very first time we fly by the Sun that we get that high velocity? And how big is that number, if you happen to know, Paul? WS2N in the Space Report, K2RIW in the TechNet.
I think we're... Venus is not. I think it's going to pass, get past Venus very shortly, and then, you know, the way the orbital mechanics are working out. So then but every time the spacecraft goes around the Sun, it will be again passing the orbit of Venus, but always coming from, like it'll go beyond the orbit of Venus, and then when it comes back. You know, as it's going toward Venus, it's actually going to be passing on the right-hand side. Like you said, for Voyager and for Pioneer, when they went out to the outer planets, they passed those planets as they passed, looking down anyway from the solar north. You would see the spacecraft passing with the planets on the left-hand side. And they're accelerating. And again, when the with the Parker probe, it's going to be passing Venus, and the Venus is going to be on the left-hand side. You would say, well, that's the wrong direction, because when it was going, you know, when the spacecraft Voyager and Pioneer, they were passing Jupiter and Saturn. That was on the left-hand side. Wouldn't the left-hand side be the wrong side for Venus? But it's not, because you're going in the opposite direction of where Voyager and Pioneer were going. So you actually need the planet on the left-hand side. If you pass Venus and you go past too late, and Venus has already passed you in the orbit, and again, you're looking down from the solar north, and you're looking down at your planet.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Paul, I'm going to make a recommendation. Stand by. When a spacecraft, an astronaut or a scientist flying a spacecraft, in his mind, he is inside of that spacecraft. Therefore, his reference is, where is the spacecraft compared to the planet? When Voyager or Pioneer flew by Jupiter, they flew the spacecraft on the right-hand side of Jupiter to get a speed up. To say that the planet is on the left-hand side is saying it backwards, and people are going to be confused by that. So put yourself inside of the spacecraft. Where is the spacecraft compared to the planet? So to speed up, you fly the right-hand side of your spacecraft flies the right-hand side of the planet. To slow yourself down, your spacecraft goes on the left-hand side of the planet. So they're going to be passing the left-hand side of Jupiter, of Venus, in order to slow down. When you say it the other way around, I think people are going to be confused. And by the way, how high a velocity, what's the highest velocity they're going to hit during this mission, and when will they hit that velocity? I know they said this is the fastest thing mankind has ever issued, but I don't remember seeing what the number was. WS2N, K2RIW, and the TechNet.
Each year we're going faster and faster. For the first pass, I forget what the number will be. But when you get all the way down to 7 years, and actually beyond, you know, NASA, they'll have extension missions. They'll extend it if everything's still operating. 430,000 miles per hour relative to the sun's surface. 430,000 miles per hour. And if you think about it, it could be actually relative to us to some degree, depending on, you know, the angle that the spacecraft is moving at the time. So that's what it is, 430,000. They gave it in kilometers in one website. It was 690,000 kilometers per hour. And somewhere else I read it was the same thing as going from New York to Washington, D.C. in 1 second. So, you know, there's a spacecraft called Helios, Helios 1 and Helios 2. They got as far as, they got within side the range of Mercury, and I think they got up to 140,000 miles per hour.
So are you saying that each of these passes by Venus is speeding them up or slowing them down? Because they're diving toward the sun, so to speak, you would think they would be too fast going toward the sun, or maybe the angle was wrong. So what happens on each one of the passes of Venus? That's not quite clear, because I didn't read the article yet, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, I should have sent the one article. I think one of them, maybe it was that one. They also had a diagram. By the way, but when you look at these diagrams, you're always looking down. You know, you're God, and you're looking down at the solar system, you know, from the north. And that's why I always think of the spacecraft-planet relationship the way I described it. But yeah, you're a good way to do it as well, as if you're inside the spacecraft, and then everything's just reversed. So yeah, if I'm in the spacecraft, my spacecraft will be to the right of Venus as I go flying by. But what Venus is doing is it's slowing my forward motion down. You know, remember, I'm going 67,000 miles per hour right now as we sit here talking to you around, you know, there's a forward motion around the sun. Now, that has to be, you know, if you were to stop, put the brakes on right now, and we are not going 67,000 miles an hour anymore, and we just stop, all of a sudden we'll start going directly toward the sun, and eventually we'll go right into the sun. So, and when we hit the sun, we'll be going probably 500,000 miles per hour. You know, just accelerate, keep on accelerating. So what's happening with this mission is you have to slow that forward motion down. You know, you've got to knock out roughly around 53,000 miles forward motion. You still want around 14,000 miles, because if you don't have that 14,000 miles an hour, you won't be able to orbit the sun. You'll be going directly into the sun. So you still need some forward motion. So you got to knock off 53,000 miles. The Delta IV rocket and the upper stage, the RL-10 cryogenic stage, and also helium, liquid helium, liquid oxygen, and that final kick motor that's supplied by Orbital ATK. All these engines will slow you down roughly 35,000 miles an hour. The rest of it, you still need to slow down. And that's why you need Venus. So every time you come near Venus, you know, as long as it's the right angle, you know, and they got it all figured out, it will actually slow that forward motion down as you're passing Venus, roughly 2,000 miles per hour every time you do that. But relationship to the, you know, don't forget now that Venus is really moving around the sun very fast, so is Mercury. So as far as the speed going around the sun, you're actually increasing. But that forward motion will be decreasing every time you pass Venus. The diagrams would be best. I should look up and find out where I saw a couple of those diagrams, and that would be the best thing to send. I should send that to Roy.
Wasn't a mathematician that first proposed using these gravity flyby of a planet to get these gravity assists? I think that was not a direct NASA development. I think it was a mathematician that first suggested that to them a zillion years ago. Do you remember who that was and what was the mission where that was first proposed, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW? It's a genius of a technique.
I'll have to look him up. I think his last name began with a Z, as in Zulu. But yeah, he kept going to the NASA meetings and he kept recommending, you know, here's what we've got to do. This is what we can do with the Voyager missions, with the pioneering missions. He wanted to use the gravity assist, and eventually he talked them into it. Sure enough, that's the way they've all done it. Now, yeah, we've got Pioneer, two of them, 10 and 11, that are leaving the solar system, and they use, you know, Mars or Jupiter and Saturn to do that. And then Voyager 1 and 2. Well, Voyager 2 used all the planets, including Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. You know, every one of them. Well, Voyager 1 didn't. It got past Mars, but then it also used Jupiter. It gained like another 8,000 miles an hour there. But then when it went to Saturn, Voyager 1, they said, you know, both spacecraft are working good. We'll let 2 continue on to the outer planets of Uranus and Neptune. But we're really interested in Saturn to look at that moon Titan. So to do that, let's go real close to Titan. But to do that, it's going to change the trajectory, like you said before, it changes the angle of where you're going. And to get in close to Titan, the way the orbital mechanics are working out, you'd have to come up under Titan, the moon of Titan, and take all your pictures and everything. But then you're going to change your degree. You're going to be going 37 degrees north of the ecliptic, out of the plane of all the planets. And so that's what happened to Voyager 1. And because of that, it's going like more direct away from the sun, where Voyager 2 is, you know, it's also leaving, but it's kind of like orbiting the sun a little bit more, you know. It's a long way around getting out of the solar system. So that's why Voyager 1 is already officially out of the solar system, and Voyager 2 has a little ways to go. Pioneer 10 and 11, they've long ago shut down, not operating, but they're going to be leaving the solar system as well. And of course now we have one more called New Horizon, and that will eventually be leaving the solar system. In fact, that's the one that a few years ago went past Pluto. Well, this January 1st is going to be going to the first Kuiper Belt. Kuiper Belt object, and you know, on January 1st, 2019. So everybody will be worried about New Year's Eve or a straight key night, which I like, but I'll also be paying attention to what New Horizon is doing. Back to you, Dick, for any other comments before I go on. This is WS2N.
Yeah, those are interesting trajectories. So, sure glad NASA listened to that mathematician who I think at the time was maybe not a NASA employee. And he had to spend quite a bit of time convincing them to use gravity assist to flybys of the planets. It's kind of wild that you can use the gravity assist to either speed up or slow down, depending on which side of the planet you fly by. Good stuff. So, 530, what was that number again? 430,000 miles an hour is what the Parker will eventually be doing, I think you said, when it's in orbit around the sun. And I presume they're going to be using gravity assist of Venus to get in the right trajectory and the right speeds, but the very last portion of the orbital insertion, I'm guessing that's going to be the firing of the gravity assist of the aperture kick motor. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2IW?
Yeah, they'll be able to use that. You know, once you fire that, that's it. It's a solid booster rocket, so a solid kick motor. So those things don't usually reignite. So I'm sure they'll have it all figured out, just, you know, exactly when they fire that. And that's one good thing about using that, you know, is you don't need, you know, two different tanks. You don't need, for instance, liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen like you do with the RL-1011. So it lasts for years. You don't need hydrazine, which sometimes could cause a problem after a couple of years. It's just solid fuel sitting there waiting to be used, or you can wait years and years, because, you know, until the right time to fire that engine, and then they'll use that. So very well planned. Originally, they planned on launching from an Atlas V with a whole bunch of booster rockets, but many years ago, they scrapped that idea and went with the even bigger rocket, the Delta IV Heavy. So I was going to say something else. Oh, yeah, I was going to talk about the heat. The idea is to get this thing within the corona of the sun, so it's going to be hot, and, you know, they're talking about, like, a million degrees. And I think last week or week before I went over that, how it could survive this million-degree temperature. One of the things they want to find out is why the corona gets so hot. Down at the surface, it might be 10 or 20,000 degrees, and yet at the corona, you're looking at a million degrees. You know, what's happening? Is there, you know, some kind of waves or sound waves or particles hitting the corona and making the corona a million degrees? Well, that's one of the things they want to figure out. So they don't want to burn it up, but they need to, because it's so rarefied, it's a million degrees, but there's very little particles there. The ones that are a million degrees, but because it's not compact, it won't transfer a lot of BTUs to the spacecraft, but still enough to cause serious damage. So the spacecraft could heat itself up to around 2,700 degrees. They need to protect that. So when they have this big, I think it's a 8-foot shield in front of the spacecraft, and it's made of carbon, the same stuff that was made at the very front of the space shuttle. It's very strong. It has the very light, but yet at the same time, it's 4.5 inches thick. And on one side, you're going to have 2,700 degrees. On the other side, it's going to be a comfortable 80 degrees. So this is the most autonomous spacecraft that they've ever made. If for any reason the spacecraft moves a little bit one way or the other, and the sun is exposed to any part of that spacecraft, you know, the back of the spacecraft, it will burn up the electronic components and everything in seconds. So they have these sensors on the peripheral part of the spacecraft, and if it starts to detect any light, you know, or, you know, coming in, it sends a signal to the spacecraft, and it will adjust itself and save itself from that type of a problem. Naturally, you can't joystick this thing, you know, when it's 90 million miles away from us. You know, the latency time just won't work out. You can't even do that with the moon. You know, you have, what, 2.5 seconds delay with the moon, two seconds delay, or you're 8 minutes delay when you're getting near the sun. And so that spacecraft is set up to save itself. It also has active, I don't want to call it a real refrigeration system. I'd rather call it a cooling system. You know, it doesn't have an evaporator and condenser, but it does have coils going to, or tubes going to the solar arrays. You know, you need power for this thing, so the solar arrays would burn up when you get that close to the sun.
I'm going to make one other comment when you get a chance up, Holger.
Okay, to get the, I think it's minimum 800 watts that they need for the solar panels. They have water going through tubes with a pump behind it, and it's going to be cooling the solar panels. The solar panels will move like back a little bit when it's near the sun, and when it's going to be an elliptical orbit. It's going to go out near Venus and then back to the sun over and over again. So when it's far away, solar panels, well, they'll be able to open them, but when it gets in close, they're going to back off, so only a little bit of the solar panels are showing, and it's going to have this cooling water effect with the pump behind it. Interesting enough, they had to put a heater on Parker, electric heater, because of this water and the tank of water and everything involved. After launch, it would freeze, and they can't have this freeze, you know, break everything. So they actually have an electric heater on board to keep the solar probe warm. It's ironic, but one of the things the engineers had to come up with. You want to make a comment, Dick? WS2N.
Yeah, I have a comment about getting something in orbit around a planet, but before I go there, I'm amazed that they're using water as a coolant. I mean, you and I don't put water in our radiator because it doesn't have a great enough range of the highest temperature before boiling and the lowest temperature before freezing. So we put ethylene glycol, we put antifreeze into our radiator where we use water for cooling our car. I'm kind of amazed they didn't do that with the water that's on Parker. Water is a very good high thermal, what's the word I'm looking for now? Thermal capacity is a better word, if you know what I mean. Specific heat. Water has a very high specific heat. It takes a lot of calories to heat water, some number of degrees Fahrenheit, or centigrade. So it's very good absorbing heat, but its temperature range is less than desirable. That's why you need this heater. I wonder why they didn't use antifreeze, Paul. Go ahead.
Yeah, they didn't say, but, you know, antifreeze has its own problems, and it has its own corrosive problems, and that's why they don't like to use that. For instance, on the International Space Station, they use ammonia, and, for that reason, also, it's a lot easier to design pumps around, just pumping water around. You know, just need a water pump. They probably grabbed it out of a car. Here, let's use this. But I went to a couple of different websites and a magazine to confirm that. So it's on a NASA site, a couple of other sites. So that's what they're using. And whatever works. And it sounds like the simplest thing, less of a chance of any kind of leaks or anything like that. They just need to pump it. And they have a radiator in the back, and that's what they're going to do. I was going to say something else about the electronics. The electronics, especially designed, there are a couple of things that are going to be actually facing the sun. They use these exotic, rarer type of metals to sort of wires and things like that. They couldn't use copper. They use aluminum or silver. If they were going to design Parker like 30 years ago, it wouldn't work. They have all this modern stuff, metallurgy. Back to you.
One of the things that's not so clear for people who are doing a celestial navigation, in other words, you're steering a spacecraft. Let's assume now I want to put a spacecraft in orbit around Mars. They put an awful lot of spacecraft in orbit around Mars. So you aim the spacecraft not so that you hit Mars, you aim it a little bit to the left or the right of Mars. And so when it gets in the vicinity of Mars and senses Mars's gravity, your spacecraft will whip around the backside of Mars and then come back toward you where you started from with a huge elliptical orbit. And in order to make that elliptical orbit circular, you have to get near Mars and then decrease some of that forward velocity. And quite a few of the spacecraft you put in Mars, in orbit around Mars, you did it by touching the atmosphere with a heat shield and let the drag of the atmosphere slow you down to get you into a more circular orbit. In the case of going to Saturn, the satellites that we put near Saturn, once you got on the backside of Saturn, you had to fire an engine, a thruster to slow yourself down to get you from that elliptical orbit into a circular orbit around Saturn. Let me drop. Now, in the case of Parker, you're trying to get into a circular orbit around the Sun. It would be very nice if you can dip into that outer atmosphere of the corona of the Sun and use it as a drag device. But since it's at 1,000,000 degrees Fahrenheit, no way in hell it'll burn up anything you got. So you got to use an Apogee kick motor to get you from an elliptical orbit to a circular orbit around the Sun. So I'm guessing when you first approach the Sun, you're at too high a velocity. And then when you fire the aperture kick motor to get into a circular orbit, I think that's where you're going to be at 435,000 miles an hour. My guess is before you fire that aperture kick...
Repeater, timeout.
My guess is that even before you fire that aperture kick motor, you're flying it even higher. If 435,000 miles an hour is what your final velocity wants to be, I'll bet you approach the Sun at an even higher velocity. It would have been an elliptical orbit if you didn't fire the aperture kick motor. Is that true, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, you're never going to be at... it's never going into a circular orbit. It's always going to be highly elliptical. So that's the deal. Like I said before, every time it's near the Sun, it's gonna fold the solar panels back. Well, most of it is not going to be exposed to the Sun. You only need a little bit for solar power. And that's when it's going to be going, you know, 500,000 miles an hour. And then it'll go up, it'll slow down again as it goes out to, I believe, close to the orbit of past Venus. And then back again each time it comes back. It's going to be coming very close. So we'll be doing science and then, you know, very close in for only, you know, a relatively short period of time compared to, you know, not 24 hours a day. It's not going to be at that speed, that constant 500,000 mile an hour speed in a solar, in a circular orbit, you know. You know what I mean, Dick? It's going to be highly elliptical.
I'm glad to know that. Okay, so, but the aperture kick motor is putting them into a lower elliptical orbit than they would have been without the aperture kick motor. I'm going to make a guess on that one. Also, I've got another guess, Paul. This is overly simplistic, but for lots of years now, they've been worrying about the corona of the Sun has got something like 1,000,000 degrees temperature. Temperature really is the average velocity of the molecules. So why are those molecules in the solar corona moving so fast? So you've got a bunch of molecules in the corona. Let's assume that they're in orbit around the Sun, so to speak. The Sun is continuously boiling off a whole lot of solar wind particles at a few million miles an hour. So the Sun is always boiling off these particles. The particles have to fly through the corona to get out here where we see them as a aurora, borealis, and australis, and so on. So we see the solar wind. It's continuously hitting the Sun. There's a lot of stuff boiling off from the Sun at millions of miles an hour. Those particles have to go through the solar corona. There's impact of those molecules of the solar wind with the solar corona particles. Whenever you're impacting particles, on average, you're going to increase their speed. When you increase their speed, we call that higher temperature. Has anyone ever mentioned something as simple as the solar wind is what's heating up the solar corona? Over to you, Paul, WS2N, KQIW.
Yeah, I've read that. That's one possibility. Another one is sound waves coming off the surface. And I think Carl Sagan had the theory, like you just mentioned, many years ago, that it could be the solar wind hitting the corona and then making that go up to a million degrees. But that's what a probe is going to be. We're going to find out. The probe won't burn up. I think explained that you could have a stove at, set at 500 degrees, and you can put your hand in it, you know, poke around. You're not going to leave it there long, but you might have to do something with the turkey. Then you take your hand out. You know, your hand was in an environment of 500 degrees, but, you know, the heat transfer wasn't that much. The difference between the heat temperature and the heat transfer to your skin. Now, you got a boiling pot of water at 212 degrees, and you reach over and you're going to grab that egg inside that plumb pot of water. You're going to put your hand in there, you're going to be in the emergency room. What happened? You know, that's only 212 degrees, but the density there is so much denser that, you know, the transfer of heat is going to put you in a hospital. And the same for the solar probe. It's going to be flying through 1 million degree temperatures. But it's so rarefied that the total amount of BTUs that are going to be transferred to that spacecraft is going to be much less, so therefore heating it up when it's close in like that to around 2,700 degrees Fahrenheit. So that's the deal. I don't know if we should continue on. I got plenty to do here, but I wanted to see if Roy was available. I'm looking at the time. Maybe propagation changed, or maybe the inputs changed. What do you think, Dick? Over to you, K2RI, WWS2M.
That's a good suggestion, Paul. So let's give Paul another chance. Let's hope the propagation has gotten better, or the amount of descents at the input of the repeater has gotten better. AC2GS, K2RIW, give us the transmission, Roy, and keep your fingers crossed. You've got it, Roy. Yeah, that was 95 or 85% noise and 15% audio and dropping out. So it looks like they're not favoring you tonight, Paul. I mean, Roy, that's terrible. We got to find out what's going on. And I think during one of the recent storms that you did lose one of your better antennas. Is that true, Roy? Is that one of the aggravating factors here? AC2GS, K2RIW. Okay, I heard you say you're going to try resource number two. Very, very noisy signal, but we'll stand by while you make a change and see if you get an improvement. AC2GS with some delay. K2RIW listening.
I think he's changing radios. Radio number two, he said that.
Okay, whatever change he's going to make, we'll stand by and see if it makes an improvement. Yeah, in the case of heating a fluid, whether it be a gaseous fluid like the corona around the sun or a water fluid in your microwave oven, the water molecule is a highly polarized molecule, and it tries to flip back and forth and follow the instantaneous heat field of the RF wave, so at 2,300 megacycles. At that rate, the water molecule is flipping back and forth. While the water molecules are hitting each other, the water molecule is moving on average 600 meters per second at room temperature. So those molecules are hitting each other at a ridiculous rate. And so they're twisting and hitting at the same time. The microwave energy twisting the molecules means that after each hit, they've got more velocity because it's a bumpy molecule hitting, so to speak. I think if you put alcohol, which I think is not a polarized molecule, if you put a glass of alcohol and a glass of water in a microwave oven, I think only the water would get warm. I'm going to have to try that experiment sometime. But these molecules of solar wind directly hitting the solar corona molecules, I can see how that can speed them up as they bounce around, if you know what I mean. Well, let's see if Roy's back with his new radio. AC2GS, K2RIW. While we're waiting for Roy to get the new radio hooked up, why don't you make another one of your space reports, Paul? WSUN, K2RIW.
Okay, last...